From your experience, how can the ocean improve our mental health?
I like to break it down into an acronym that you use the word PERM. And out of that acronym, you have positivity, empathy, resilience, and mindfulness. And I think there's a number of different aspects of the way we engage with the coastline or ocean or even water. My medium is surfing, which is essentially engaging with breaking waves and the movement of those waves. And it's important not to think in a heroic sense about wave riding being the biggest, best wave. Waves can be extremely safe and gentle. And a lot of the surfing that I celebrate and do is often in very safe, easy to ride waves. And how I like to break it down is the beauty of just being in the ocean, but particularly riding waves on any type of board or body, whether it's you lying or standing or not even having a board at all in the style of body surfing, is that positivity is something that happens. You feel good about the experience. Empathy is really important because you're sharing the experience with others. But once you get in the mindset of recognizing that you're always sharing the experience with the bigger body of the environment, then that's an important thing as well, because even if you're surfing alone as a human being, you're also sharing that experience with sea life, with the jellyfish, with the seals, with the dolphins. Even if you're not seeing them, they're there. And resilience is a very powerful thing that being in breaking waves teaches you, because the wipeout is as much part of the experience as the ride. And getting back up for more and going back out to catch another wave is a real great learning journey. And of course, mindfulness is simply being in the present, and anything that allows you to reduce any clutter in your mental and physical being and focus on the here and now is a really important thing in society. And it's been something that has been celebrated back thousands of years ago to the ancients and will be something extremely important as we move forward. And there are many activities that allow you to be present in that state of mindfulness. And the great thing about being in the ocean is because it's in a state of flux, it's a three-dimensional environment, just physically being there immediately facilitates your awareness of the light, the watercolor, the salt, the tides, the texture of the sand under your feet, the movement of the breaking water. And those elements, positivity, empathy, resilience, and mindfulness, for me that's the great acronym that really encapsulates why wave riding is such a powerful opportunity for people from all backgrounds. And they may well not live at the coast. They may be accessing waves at a new generation of surf lakes, or they may be coming to the coast once in their year, or they may be just engaging with blue health through swimming in a river or a lake. But I think what's really special about surfing is it's all of that with the movement, the dance of actually physically riding to shore on that breaking wave.
And how and why does it declutter the mind? Is it just because you're focusing so much on trying to ride the wave and just trying to be in the water? Or what do you think the maybe underlying mechanisms are for the reason why we can just relax when we're in the water, even if it's some quite menacing experience to begin with?
Well, there's a lovely kind of synergy between what Jay Wallace Nichols described as the blue mind and the red mind with surfing. And Jay's book, which really kind of set the threshold for the relationship between surfing and mindfulness, was a real game changer. And he talked about with a lot of action activities and action sports, particularly surfing, there is a sense of the red mind overtaking, which can be fear, adrenaline, anxiety, if you see the power of the ocean in front of you, or if you are troubled by the people around you because of the behavior that they exhibit. That's that sense of the red mind kind of letting off steam. But juxtaposed to that is the blue mind, which is linked to flow state and that opportunity to be completely channeled on what is coming at you and what you're doing. And I think that lots of people who do go to the sea, they do experience both. And that's why I really like to celebrate small wave surfing, because a lot of people are worried that they're going to be embarrassed wearing a wetsuit if they're surfing in a temperate climate like we do in the UK. They're going to be uncomfortable wearing something so revealing as a tight-fitting wetsuit. They're going to be scared by the power of the waves. They're going to be on the wrong equipment. They're going to be with friends that maybe make them feel like they're not as good as them. And I think that it's really important to consider, you know, when, where, and how you're engaging with the coastline. And then that kind of reduces the overwhelming feeling of the red mind, where it's going to be too scary and too much. So my advice is, for if you are worried about crowds, you know, look to surf in some marginal conditions where the waves might not be as good as other beaches, but there will be a lot less people, as long as it's safe and you're with the right people and using the right equipment. And then at that stage, you can really appreciate the opportunities of the blue mind, where, first of all, seeing and reading the sea is an important start point. Looking out to the horizon, deciding what the tide's doing, what the wind's doing, what the conditions are, where people are positioned. And then, you know, safely entering that space. And I feel, for me, that there's a little bit of a transition between physically starting to see the coast and getting excited. And I see that with my kids, particularly, say they've had a busy day at school and we're lucky enough to live on the coast, and we walk down the cliff and start to read the sea. And already there's this beautiful transition where the mindfulness is really starting to take over, you know, all of the things that they've been going through in the day are now starting to be completely forgotten about, because the focus is starting to channel towards, wow, look at those beautiful left-handers peeling across the bay, you know, look at that rainbow, look at that rain squall on the horizon. And then it gets more and more focused as you actually enter the water, and you're completely engulfed in seeing the waves, deciding how you're going to get out to the waves, sitting up on your board, noticing where the next wave is coming from, paddling for that wave, if you're successful, catching it, maybe lying or standing and riding that wave to the inside and feeling that eruption of joy from the movement, the dance, the momentum, and then wanting to go out and do the same thing. And the beauty of an activity like surfing is that it never repeats, in the sense that, unlike skiing or skateboarding or BMXing, where the terrain is fixed, the changing ocean environment means that every single wave is different, sometimes only subtly different, but different enough to make every single ride, every single experience unique. And the great thing about surfing is that it's not just the popping up and the riding towards the sand, whether you're a beginner or an expert or a professional. It's also the paddling out through the water. It's the sitting on the board. It's the shared space with sea life, with other surfers, with the natural environment. And I think the sensitivity you develop towards the natural environment in that situation is a really powerful opportunity to promote environmental activism, because as a participant in a blue-green space, you will be the first person to notice if there is excessive pollution, if there is unusual discoloration of the water, if there's, you know, massive microplastics on the shore, lots of fishing nets or detritus in the water. Or if you look back to shore and you realize, oh my gosh, they're building a massive new range of housing or marina on this bit of coastline. You know, is that going to affect the natural movement of sand or the mangrove, or is that going to increase the population of people accessing the beach? So this sensitivity towards the environment is something that surfing really fosters. And I think that's a really important opportunity for new generations to be doing things. It's not unique to surfing. Of course, it's unique to a lot of outdoor activities, whether you're mountain biking, whether you're hiking or walking. But if you are in the natural environment, you're going to be tuned to any negative impacts on it. And you're going to be one of the first people to campaign or at least raise a voice against, you know, what's happening here and why, and what can we do about it to create a more sustainable situation so other people can continue to enjoy these opportunities.
Mm. And just going back a bit to the mindfulness part, we often say we need peace of mind, but a lot of the time we need peace from our minds. And surfing and being in the water, like you described with your kids going down after school, where they see the rainbow and they see the waves and they can see everything going on in this dynamic environment, that takes us away from the clutter, like you said earlier, and the stress, and projects us away from our problems and our little world and to the bigger and wider environment, which must just help us relax. And also, like you said, make us more tuned to the environmental problems that are going around. I mean, I don't surf at the moment, but whenever I've been out in nature bird watching, I start with a passion of seeing all the birds, seeing the nature. And then the more you spend in that time, the more changes you see, both positive and negative. So I think the best way for people to care about the environment is just to be in it, right?
Absolutely. And I think that one of the arguments I really tried to progress in the Mindfulness and Surfing book that was published in 2016, which has sold really well and had a lot of great positive feedback around the world, because it has a Spanish edition and it sells well globally, is that it's not just about the Asian philosophy of mindfulness inside us, which I think can verge onto the self-obsession that we see from social media. It's more about the bigger body mind of our place within the world. And that's something that I was really keen to write about and talk about in that book, because I didn't want to add to, you know, a fantastic list of world-class work from, you know, ancient Taoism through Buddhism to, you know, contemporary kind of Zen mindfulness that internalizes that experience, which of course is extremely important for people. What I wanted to do was recognize that it's our place in the bigger body mind of the blue planet that we share. And that's what I wanted to really kind of discuss with the way surfing positions you, is that yes, we declutter and we allow a clarity of thought and experience through being in a physical space that allows us to not worry about stresses and anxieties, but celebrate this in front of us and around us and take, you know, and make the most out of that moment in the here and now. I wanted to say, actually, we're in a shared space here in this blue planet, and the bigger body mind of the planet is what we center ourselves in. And therefore, yes, we are decluttered, but we're also attuned to the sea life, the social situation around us, and the changing weather patterns. And that links to the environmental activism. But at the same time, I think that any action sports is on this fine line between the blue and the red mind. And
yeah,
through having children and introducing an activity that I've loved since a small person and have excelled in professionally and seen and been around lots of like high performing outcomes for some of the best in the world. Through having children, I really learned about the nuances of the negative impacts of the red mind, that being the danger, the overwhelmingness, this will put them off for life because you've thrown them in at the deep end.
Yeah.
And I think that it's really important at any level of activity to step slowly and safely, so you develop confidence, resilience, and then you can make your own decision as to how you will test your limits. And that may well be skateboarding at the skate park and learning to drop in to a small mini ramp that's only waist high and thinking, you know, I've got the confidence now to build up to the steeper drop in, or maybe recognizing that's not for me. And if I take that now to the sea experience of introducing surfing to my kids, knowing that developing a love of moving water and an appreciation of going under the water, learning to read the sea, those are important stepping stones before you really even need to be lying on the board. And then holding the board, handling the board, celebrating that the wipeout in the small surf is as fun as the ride in the small surf. And then through the confidence developed, building up to more powerful and more critical waves, rather than being a parent that throws your children in at the deep end and expects them to be adrenalized and like immediately, you know, celebrate the danger side. That's a good way of, you know, newcomers being frightened from the activity for life. And I think that that, you know, building up slowly is a really important thing. And one of the great activities that we've done very well in Britain for over 100 years is a wooden belly boarding. And that's like a big part of the narrative of how people have engaged with the coastline of the UK, in Wales, in Devon, in Cornwall, in the Channel Islands, in, you know, in summer holidays, riding small waves on wooden belly boards since the, you know, early 1920s. And that is a really safe way of enjoying breaking waves. And it's a really great starting point for anybody to kind of access safely the love of the sea. And the fact that we have a lot of sand bottom beaches around the UK where you can ride those waves gently right up to the sand, and there's no rocks to cut you, and there's a support and nourishment in the way we have a lifeguard culture of surveillance to kind of manage that space safely. And that's a wonderful starting point for kids to then think, is this an activity I'm going to do more of on different equipment at more challenging locations?
Mm-hmm. Do you have any stories maybe of yourself or other people whose lives have been positively transformed from surfing or being exposed to the ocean?
Well, as a events commentator, I work in longboard events for the World Surf League and the International Surf Association. So this, the WSL and the ISA are the acronyms for those two governing bodies of surfing. And I also commentate at parasurf events. And as a writer, when the adaptive sports movement in surfing really started to take off from the early 2000s, I was often writing profiles on some of the new wave of parasurfers. And annually, I commentate at the ISA World Parasurfing Championship. And that's a very exciting aspect of surfing because it embodies a number of different approaches. Essentially, it's about adapting equipment to suit your impairment so you can perform at the highest level. But in companionship with adaptive and parasurfing, you have surf therapy. And in the last 20 years, surf therapy has really kind of taken off and thrived around the world, and particularly in the UK. So there's an organization called the Wave Project that's been a pioneer of surf therapy, and it's been funded by the National Health Service. And that's about allowing teenagers and young children to treat ailments through safe access to water. And I think my favorite, most inspiring story of the power of the ocean is the Falmouth surfer, Charlotte Bamfield, who has grown up with high-level autism and cerebral palsy, and suffered from a lot of bullying, isolation through that, was enrolled in the Wave Project's surf therapy program, found it to have transformative benefits with her mental health, her physical well-being, and her enjoyment. And off the back of a natural skill she developed for surfing, she then evolved into a competitive parasurfer and has won 2 gold medals in her category in the stand division of the World Parasurfing Championships. Both of those golds were won in Huntington, California, one last winter and one the previous winter. And I was lucky enough to be a commentator on those finals when she won. And to think back to Charlotte's journey, that surfing was introduced to her through a surf therapy program funded by the NHS, and then to go on to the elite level of performative sport, competing with the world's best in her division, winning gold medals. And I think that that's a really great example of this lovely synergy that adaptive surfing offers between the network of surf therapy that continues to this day for all levels of surfers who may only access it once or twice or 6 times, all the way through to the highest level international performers who want to professionalize adaptive surfing. And Charlotte has a really nice role in the surf exhibition that I've curated at the National Maritime Museum, Cornwall in Falmouth, which celebrates 100 years of wave riding. And it has 100 boards across 100 years and lots of interesting narratives and photos. And it has one of Charlotte's adaptive boards that was designed by Ben Skinner in Newquay, and some of Charlotte's medals and trophies and content around her surfing journey. And as kind of alumni of Falmouth and it being in the Maritime Museum in Falmouth, her elements in the exhibition for me like really kick all the boxes for this is a great example of the power of wave riding.
And how do these power surfers, how is their board adapted to be able to allow them to surf? What is that? Could you describe it to me?
Well,
hey guys, first of all, I want to say thank you. There's one person who's been sharing the podcast more than anybody else, and that is you. The only reason why this podcast continues to grow is because you are sharing it. And my only ask is, if this podcast has provided value to you or you think it'll provide value to somebody else, then if you could send them a DM of the link or a screenshot to the show, that would genuinely make my day. And it's the only way the podcast will continue to grow. That's my only ask of you. Thank you very much.
Great thing about the adaptive surf movement is there are a number of different categories to compete under. So at the elite level of competition, there will be 9 different categories. And you are put in your category based on your physical impairment. And so there may well be, there's prone categories and the standing categories and sitting categories. And so the standing categories have three divisions, and they will be based on whether you have upper body impairments or lower body impairments. And when it comes to the lower body, it may be whether that impairment is above the knee or below the knee. So obviously, if your impairment is above the knee, that's influencing your riding technique and your maneuvers differently to if your impairment is below your knee or in your upper body. And then there's 2 levels of prone categories where one is prone assist, where the surfer riding lying will be assisted to be pushed into the waves and assisted to get back out to the breaking point of the waves. And then there's another prone category, which is non-assist, where the lying down surfer will be paddling out unaided, catching the waves unaided. So you have these 3 different standing divisions, these 2 lying divisions. Now we call that prone. And then you have a kneeling division. And then you have a sitting division where you will ride a surf ski. And then you have a vision impaired category where there's the partial vision and the blind surfers. And so across those 9 different categories, every athlete will have adapted their technique and their equipment accordingly. So Charlotte Bamfield will have handles on her board that help her carry the board down to the beach. But she'll also have handles on her board that allow her to work with her cerebral palsy and autism that has a physical impact on all of her limbs to lean on the board appropriately when she catches a wave and cops up. So she likes to have a handle across the front of the board, which helps her if she's, paddling out through the waves and going under the breaking waves. But she also uses that handle to support her when she pops up. And you may well have prone surfers who have handles particularly positioned based on, they may well have been an ex-professional or Olympic athlete in a particular category and had a spinal cord injury. Like Elena Nichols, for example, is a famous alpine para snowboarder who had a big spinal cord injury and has become a multiple world champion in the sit ski. So she will be adapting her equipment based on her spinal cord injury and the mobility of her upper body. So some surfers that may be surfing prone, they may have great movement in their hands and elbows, but no trunk strength through their spinal cord and their core. Whereas there may be a surfer in the same division who has been an amputee, like Jose Martinez is a famous American champion para surfer who's a triple amputee, a war veteran. So he's using one arm, and he's an amputee off another arm and above the knee on both legs. But he's got great core strength and he's got really good spinal cord movement. So his board is adapted accordingly to facilitate the fact that he's got a really good core trunk strength. Now he's going to be competing against Jesse Balawa, or Mark Hager from Bournemouth. Jesse's from California, Mark's from the UK. That Jesse has had a spinal cord injury surfing. So his movement is from his elbows to his hand. So he's steering from up here. but he won't have strength through his spinal cord or his core. And Mark Hager has multiple sclerosis that is affecting his spine, so that his movement is also in in his elbows and his shoulders and his vision. And it's really quite inspiring to see how all these different athletes tweak their equipment, working with surfboard builders to maximize their skills and work with their impairment. And that's why we call it adaptive sports, because you're adapting your equipment to get the best performance possible. And there's a really nice new generation now of surfboard builders who are beginning to specialize in making adaptive surfboards. A good friend of mine called Ben Way, who's from California, who works as well as an ISA events commentator and announcer. He's also a really good surfboard shaper who's built a lot of fantastic adaptive equipment for a lot of the best international para surfers. And, you know, the relationship that the shapers and the surfers have is really exciting, because it verges into like Formula One-esque engineering, and yeah, the sky's the limit. It's only the beginning. I feel as if para surfing gets in the Paralympics, then there will be a lot more funding opportunities to push that level of engineering.
Wow, that's so cool. I'm going to have to watch some videos after of some of the para surfers. That's so cool. And are there any tough moments in your life that you've had where surfing or exposure to the ocean has helped you pull through or helped you deal with it? Are there any examples of that for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have always juggled a variety of activities with surfing. I never set out to be a professional surfer or live out of the surf industry or surf media. I really was more focused on having got a place to study geography at Cambridge University and fulfill an academic career, or perhaps move into the world of travel writing or travel filmmaking, were some of the things I thought I would like to do whilst I was studying geography at Cambridge. But the surfing started to thrive alongside, and I used my love of geography, travel, communities, adventure activism with my surfing, working with photographers, competing, and then moving into film work. And I think through a lot of the ups and downs of both platforms, what I recognized is that with any physical activity, injuries are inevitable. And, you know, the depression you experience as an athlete when you go through injuries is really demoralizing, and it can be quite scary. And in those situations, you really then appreciate the validity of having balance in your life. I mean, the brain is also a muscle, and being able to exercise the brain through a balance to your physical activity is really essential. And there were times when I had injuries through surfing where I was very grateful for the opportunity for book work, for magazine editing, for academia, for film work, which felt like I could balance out the lack of opportunities to, you know, to be physical where I was getting through an injury. And also vice versa, you know, the times when you're very deep in, you know, using the brain in your work or your career, like, for instance, when I was in the deepest stages of researching a PhD and writing my PhD to deadlines, when PhDs are big, long-winded, but deep projects that contribute a small bit of specialism to a field that you then, you know, contribute to. And you have to really immerse yourself in those, and they are, you know, it can be very draining. And it's some times like that when the physical activity of being able to get outdoors, have a paddle, have a swim, have a surf, have a walk, be nature-based through blue and green health, have been absolutely priceless to sustain that level of mental health. And I think for a lot of people immersed in very demanding careers or jobs where they maybe are very screen-based, or it's very office-based, or meeting-based, or even private in the sense you're working from home and you're very deep in demanding tasks, knowing that you have the freedom to be able to get out and do something physical and embodied is really important. And that's an essential balance. And I think surfing's really taught me the need for balance. And I've had big injuries. I've had disappointing competition periods where I put a lot of pressure on myself. But I think that through having the network of a good family who recognized balance is a key aspect to this. I was always able to move between slightly different activities to shift focus when it was required, so that I didn't, you know, have all my eggs in one basket and it was not all about that particular outcome. So I see a lot of young athletes today, whether they're tennis, whether they're Formula One, whether they're mountain biking, skateboarding, whether they're surfing, and I can see the pressure that they're under if they are excelling at a young age. And I also recognize one of the most healthy opportunities for them is to have other activities that help them feel good, or other ways to engage with the wider community. And I think, you know, I saw most change in my own appreciation of the good, you know, the good opportunities I had once I started to travel to, you know, lesser known surfing coastlines where surfing was either new or it was emerging, and seeing places like Liberia where surfers are in a post-conflict environment off the back of a civil war, and relative to the trauma of loss of family and complete political and economic disruption through either a war-based or even an environmental catastrophe, surfing offered a great platform to rebuild. And, you know, I've seen that in many countries, whether it be in the context of Haiti, post-earthquake, post-political turmoil, or somewhere like Liberia, post-civil war, young surfers becoming stewards of their coastline, you know, loving something, but also recognizing it was a building block to become a lifeguard, to look after a new emerging middle class of people from their capital cities who might come to the coast to holiday and learn to swim and learn to surf, or to open a guest house or offer facilities for traveling tourists who then they learn cultural exchange from, they learn new languages, they see bigger horizons, bigger pictures. So seeing surfing relative to the trauma of environmental or political conflict, that for me is where I really started to appreciate the power of surfing and how lucky I have been in my own career, but also how determined I then have been to make sure that I share stories of where surfing is for social good and also environmental good.
And for those young, ambitious, driven people who want to become high achievers, if they're so dedicated to surfing or whatever craft they're doing, and from your experience, you know that it's good to have a balance or do some other activities that will help them stop having the red brain, the monkey brain turned on, the stress levels high. What ratio, if you, on a day-to-day basis, do you think is a good balance between working on your craft and then doing those other beneficial activities?
That's a really great question. And I think we're still establishing how we sit as human beings relative to our increased amount of screen time through social media and the almost overwhelming flood of romanticized visions that we get of the things that we love, because there are things we look at mostly on our social media platforms. So if we're passionate about skateboarding, we're just getting flooded with all these incredible other skateboarders around the world doing what we may never be able to do. And you get the same with surfing. A lot of surfing is inaccessible to most people because it's the best in the world doing things that are too dangerous or inaccessible for most. So I think that managing screen time is probably one of the most important elements of, you know, the new world. And I think, you know, reestablishing the role of play and uncertainty is absolutely essential, irrespective of your age, and recognizing that it's okay to be terrible at something. And, you know, I think that everybody has different types of personalities with regards to how they cope with not being a high performer. And what you do see is lots of people who are putting a lot of pressure on themselves to get their A-level results that we've just recently had, or to get through university, or to perform well enough in their jobs to move up the ladder and maybe, you know, kind of be managing their own companies. I think that it's very important to recognize that high achievement and high performance is not essential. What's what, you know, that may be something that drives you, but what will allow you to have more sustainable mental health, friends and family, networks, the outdoors, and also celebrating being bad at things. It's okay to pick up a musical instrument and be terrible at it. It's okay to try to juggle and never work out how to juggle, because that will stimulate other neural paths in your physical being, and it will allow you to kind of be more humble. And I've had a really special experience recently where my good friends from California have been visiting, and my friend Brett Jordan, who is a world-class shortboard surfer, but he has a congenital heart condition that requires heart surgery in certain cycles. And in the most recent heart surgery, he had a stroke. And so he's recovering from his stroke and has almost no feeling on one side of his body, but he is getting back to surfing at a very strong level, but recognizing what level that might now be relative to the level before the most recent heart surgery and stroke. And just for me and my daughter Lola and my son Ruben, my stepdaughter Cara, my wife Sandy, my dad Alan, to share surfs with him and see the progress he's made while he's been visiting us in Cornwall, from first of all, just it being an important step to physically step into the water safely, to paddle out, to, you know, sit with balance on the board, to then, you know, getting waves again and starting to maneuver his board. You know, that has been really special, and it really reinforces the need to be out of your comfort zone, because, you know, not everybody has got access to the tools and the physical embodiment that we all have. And recognizing that it's okay to, you know, not be good at something. It's okay to try something new, to put, you know, to have a different perspective on something. And I think that, you know, with the, you know, kind of social and political challenges we have, I really want to foster much more bridge building between different perspectives and ideas of tolerance and communication. I think for every kind of accelerated focus the school systems will have on improving literacy and maths, it's more about, well, how can we tolerate and communicate? You know, how can we come up with new ways of accepting difference so that different religious or cultural perspectives can be tolerated well, so that as a young generation, we learn how to communicate and accept and work collaboratively. Because if we continue to be conflictual about the way we are through environmental activism, through our religious, political, cultural, social differences, there's no opportunity for common ground and tolerance and acceptance. And I'm not quite sure what the recipe is, but one of the things you learn with a family or in a long-term relationship is compromise. And, you know, it wasn't this, it wasn't that, but how do we celebrate a bit of all of it? And I would love to see that as part of the kind of the part of the process to balance these like driven individuals who are high performing, high achieving, high pressure with, you know, how can we be a bit of everything and nothing and, you know, more holistic? You know, there's this ultimate outcome, but how can we celebrate an ultimate outcome as something that didn't have a yes or a no? It had a meandering maybe, but that meandering maybe was a really safe outcome to embrace the perspective of this community, this environment, that identity, and this. And I think that there's a lot of need to revisit our education system to really bring in ideas of difference, tolerance, communication, acceptance, compromise as equally important things to learn, alongside maths and literacy and computer skills and physical education.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the thing with social media is it can get you into an echo chamber because of the way the algorithm works. It just leverages your confirmation bias. If you have a confirming belief and you like that post, it'll just keep pushing you that and then not show you the other side of the world. And going off of social media and touching grass and speaking to like your local people, your local community, if it's in the sauna, for example, if it's in the gym or if it's surfing or if it's on the beach, and getting different people's opinions in the real world, where there is that social compromise where you're not going to just start cussing and swearing at someone like you maybe would on Twitter, for example. I think the less time we can spend on social media and the more time we can spend in places that are in the real life and around us and with people that we may not have spoken to before or would usually speak to on social media, the better. Do you agree?
Absolutely. And I think that's why, you know, education and universities are so important to celebrate and support. And I'd love to think that, you know, the funding platforms were there to allow universities to bring together a wider community of people from a wider range of backgrounds. Because I think that it's at a great age in people's lives where they're becoming young adults, but they still could benefit from the safety net of uncertainty. And I think it's totally fine to not know what you're doing or why. That feeling may well last with you throughout your entire lives. But we kind of demonize that. You know, we make people think you've got to know what subject you're doing and why and what career you need to have. But it's okay to be intermodal and holistic. And I think universities are great places to have that kind of safety net where you're discovering your levels of passion, interest, and expertise whilst recognizing what isn't stimulating you so much. But you're getting a nice variety of different ideas and communities and shared perspectives, and you're building networks that of friendships and that can last forever. And it may well be that you're not necessarily doing the subject you would ever do in your career or you would ever fall back on, but you're learning all of the transferable skills of problem solving, of communicating, of tolerance, of sharing ideas, of working as a team or working as an individual when you need to. And I think that that's something that, you know, I really, really see with, you know, the university system. I hope it continues to stay robust, because when a university is working well, it supports, you know, a generation of people at an age in their lives where it's very exciting, because people have great potential and they should never be told that they're not good enough or they should be doing this or that. They should just be supported to explore and discover. And, you know, if there's fresh perspectives that emerge from that, it's really exciting. And you know, I almost think that maybe we're at a time when we need less specific kind of topics to study and more like overview-based things, in the sense, you know, that's the good thing about the international baccalaureate system versus A-levels is A-levels are helpful if you're just these subjects. IB is helpful if you're doing a lot of things. And then there's all the new diplomas that are much more practice-based. But it's almost like having an indefinable subject that's got no name, but it really supports you if you're not certain where you're going, but you know that you're going to benefit from a lot of the transferable skills you pick up in that 3-year period of your life when you're becoming a young adult, but you really would benefit from the safety net of community. And you know, it's a really important time. And I've really appreciated seeing through my own work as a filmmaker and in travel and commentating, you know, the value of education and how really our teachers from the, you know, the primary school level up to, you know, academics lecturing at universities, they're such important members of society. And it would be great to think that the teaching profession, even through primary school and secondary school, is one of the higher paid career paths. Yeah. Because it's so special to see as a parent, you know, your children going off to school and coming back feeling good, you know, like if they're feeling happy and fulfilled and you know, and curious. And, you know, I think that that would be a great shift in the economy if we could reframe the opportunities for teachers to be empowered more as, you know, one of the aspirational high paid careers, because the impact that, you know, they have as carers, as supporters, as leaders in their community is so special. And that level of kind of nourishment you get that in anything you do. But whilst people are moving through primary and secondary school, the impact a good supportive teacher has is game changing.
Definitely. And when you teach, you also learn. Like when you teach, two people learn. And I think if we can all become teachers at whatever we find interesting or passionate about, the better, because we're going to be connecting better with people, but also learning ourselves. And with the interdisciplinary thing, I totally agree that specialization is for insects. And especially when we're young and a lot of people don't know what they're doing, learning a whole bunch of different things and just following your intellectual curiosity is probably one of the most important things. And it is a reason why I've started this show and why the show is so interdisciplinary, because I am like photographer initially, but I've always been interested in so many different topics. And why would I not continue to explore those topics? Because there's always going to be benefits from these different fields that you can combine to create whatever you want to do with the rest of your life. So I totally agree with you on that behalf. And I think the education system, I don't know about in other countries, but in the UK with the A-levels, it encourages you to narrow down and often shoves STEM, like science, technology, engineering, maths, I think that's what it stands for, down your throat. But what if you are into the liberal arts or into philosophy or into, you know, oceanography, you know?
Yeah.
It is important to explore different things, right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, coming from West Cornwall, you know, one of our kind of like heroes in science, arts and education is Humphrey Davy, who comes from a period of time where the arts and science, you know, worked together much more closely. So he was a proofreader of the works of Coleridge whilst being an eminent scientist. And I often fantasize about what Humphrey Davy would have been like if he was a surfer of that period, relative to, you know, how wave riding was happening in Polynesia at the time. And I think that kind of mentality of like fusing the arts and science, that, you know, I was looking back at before we started, just thinking of some of my own work. And so one of my first books that you know, the emblem already, Brilliant Corners, is taking the name from Thelonious Monk's album, Brilliant Corners. So there's already like a jazz idea of Thelonious Monk was a great metaphor for somebody who would explore the cobwebs in music and take risks and go to the hidden areas and shed light onto them. And through kind of having a compendium of like of the work of John Callahan, who was a great photographer who I'd worked with throughout my career, you know, my early career, I wanted to use this as a chance to explore jazz music, improvisation, and the relationship between surfing and travel, and how we can see surfers as musicians improvising against the wave face. And what was really nice is I was able to go from having written about places through, you know, working with a photographer, but then go on my own odyssey researching the history of 50s to 60s kind of Blue Note period jazz. And that for me was an opportunity to not only share interconnectedness between disparate topics, but my own journey. And you know, the moving into the kind of the, you know, the mindfulness and surfing books, that like that one that's, you know, it you know, has that popularity and is, you know, gets lots of nice feedback. But bringing in ideas of music and ecology and the idea of kind of from the ego to the eco, you know, from inside the head to the ecology of our position within the wider world was really important. And this small book here, which is called Mindful Thoughts for Surfers, all of the different, you know, topics like sea awareness, attention to connection, the blessing of the board, a place together, salt water play, learning from the wipeout. So many of those topics have come out of my own experience of being a parent and introducing the sea safely to my kids and, you know, connecting with the equipment we're riding, whether it's the natural rubber Ulux wetsuit, whether it's the locally sourced board from locally sourced materials made by a local artisan, you know, and developing that ability to read the environment. But also, I think an important thing that we talked about is that idea of play, you know, and that, you know, it's okay to be bad at things. It's okay to take risks mentally, physically, but it's okay to just mess around, to like, you know, to draw with your left hand if you're right-handed, because it's going to look awful. But why is that a problem? And to do things that you're no good at, because if we don't celebrate play and mess, we will never have that wonderful synergy between the arts and the science that I think makes society interesting.
Definitely, 100% agree. And what's one surprising fact about surfing that most people don't know?
That the longest surfboard in the world in 1999 was made by Tim Mellors in Newquay in Cornwall, and it was 37 feet. And it got the world record for the most number of people riding it, that was 11 and then 16. The world record for the single person, which was the builder Tim Mellors riding the biggest surfboard. Unfortunately, the record was broken later in 2015 in Huntington Beach on a 45-foot longboard with many more people, but it was done first in Cornwall. And that 37-foot surfboard, which is a beautiful red long surfboard with a single fin, with the core, the blank of the board, all made by Tris Cokes, who had a brand called Homeblown with his factory in Red Ruth, using environmentally friendly processes and materials to make the core of the surfboard before it's laminated in the fiberglass and resin. So it's all made in Cornwall. It's in the exhibition at the Maritime Museum in Falmouth. And, I love it when some of the backwaters of an activity produce some of the most innovative outcomes. And that's what's so cool about the British surf scene, is that we associate the activity with Hawaii, where its ancient roots are, around the Pacific, and also America and Australia and South Africa. And obviously France is a big hotbed. But we have a long history of a very creative working class surfing community who quickly had to learn how to make their own wetsuits, make their own boards, carve their own niches, because they couldn't afford to buy the items imported from other like leading areas. And that created a really creative industry. And the surfing exhibition at the Maritime Museum kind of really celebrates some of that. And, Tim's board is one of many mind-blowingly creative outcomes that would just blow people's minds if they were listening in Australia or the US or Hawaii, where surfing is really much more in the limelight than it is in the UK.
Yeah, I need to see a picture of like 60 people on a 45-foot surfboard. That is crazy. And could you explain to me what a coupe is?
That's a classic question. So in the emergence of surfing coming out of Hollywood in California, where it's starting to get used as a kind of medium to tell stories, particularly the Gidget films off the back of best-selling books made in the late 50s, there's a juxtaposition between like the valley kooks who are from inland, who are coming to the coast, and the locals who are masters. You never master the ocean, but they're already like experts on the board and in the water. And, the lack of awareness that the outsider has versus the local has that juxtaposition of the kook, who is somebody who is in the way, they have got no sea awareness, they're dangerous, they need to get rescued, and the local surfer. So, that whole ideology gets reinforced in emerging surf communities around the world, where the kook is somebody who's doesn't know the rules. You get that brilliantly reinforced in great films like Big Wednesday by John Milius, who the film was made in the late 70s, but he's a contemporary of Spielberg and Lucas, went to film school with them. Great film about surf narratives. You get it in a mid-80s film called North Shore. You get it in cartoons and comics. But at the end of the day, the best surfers don't fall into those traps. It's a lot of the middle ground wannabes who kind of sometimes fall into those traps of demonizing the outsider. But really, when you gain wisdom from the Stephanie Gilmores of the world and the Kelly Slaters and the Laird Hamiltons and the Charlotte Bounfields, they really are wonderful ambassadors of Stoke, in the sense that they really believe in the fulfillment of what the ocean gives, and they would not demonize someone for being an outsider or a kook. They would be the ones who try to help educate them to pick up naturally some of the skills that make the middle level surfers not demonize them as the kook. But it's essentially the insider outsider. And you get that in tourism, the hosts and guests, in the sense that we go to Barcelona as visitors, we walk down Las Ramblas, and then we see the local community of Barcelona look at us as outside visitors, and we're the kooks and they're the locals. And that's why this whole idea of difference and tolerance and communication and acceptance is something that I think should be a subject to learn at school. So the juxtaposition between host and guest, kook and local, is not so acute, and it's much more embraced as a normal thing and as a community, we safely embrace the outsider and show them how to engage with this activity safely and vice versa.
Yes. We just have that built-in in-group, out-group bias that we need to like almost de-learn or mitigate. And it's funny that the, I guess we all are midwits at something. And it's funny that the middle, people in the middle are the most like almost insecure about it, in the sense that they like are trying to like put down the newbies, but then the masters are the ones who don't say anything and that are chilled because they're secure in themselves. They know how comfortable they are, and it almost makes them humble in a way. And that's not just in surfing, that's in like almost everything, where the people that are slightly more advanced than the beginners begin to, I don't know, just start hating on the people that they probably were only like a year or two ago.
And I think that that comes back to the role of the world as teachers as well, as sharers of ideas and processes, in the sense that, you know, when somebody is demonized and it's because maybe they perform dangerously, then, you know, it's an opportunity for people who've got more experience or expertise to share some wisdom and say, that actually, if you were to position yourself here in the water, it would be safer. You'd have more fun. You'd get more waves. Or maybe that person then is motivated to create a series of signs at those surf breaks or beaches that outline some of the basic rules for the first time, is to see, oh, well, okay, this is the safe place to be paddling and waiting for waves. This is the place where the more experienced surfers might be riding the waves. This is some of the basic rules of how to not be dangerous. And it's often kind of reinforced and perpetuated by people with the insecurities, and they're the ones that are frustrated in their own level. But it's also important for people to share knowledge, and, you know, for people who've got great experience. And a lot of the people who have the best experience are not necessarily the highest performing, but they have got a lot of wisdom to share. They may be the older generation. They may even be very young, but they've got a lot of depth of experience because they've been doing it for a long time. And, you know, being comfortable, but not condescending, sharing knowledge for people to engage with things safely, I think is really important.
Definitely, 100%. As a few ending questions, first one is, if you could give your 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be?
That the surf industry won't make you any money. So if you want to have a healthy bank account, don't get into trying to live off surfing. But if you want to have a smile on your face and a healthy life, then yes, I'm grateful for that. But I would have had a much more kind of fruitful mortgage repayment system if I got into renewable energy at 20-year-old self. But I'm not sure I would have looked back at 46 with the adventures and the shared experiences I've had. So I'm grateful for that.
And this is going to have to be quite a brief answer. So I know you're tight for time, but what is the side of surfing that most of the public don't see? Because we see this tan, blonde hair, good shape, riding the waves like an effortless. But if you're a pro surfer, what's the struggles that we don't get to see?
I think that the surf industry globally is so much smaller than, you know, the emerging sports like women's football. You know, if you're going to get into, you know, broadcasting, that's a really exciting emerging opportunity with attention and funding and growth. But if you think of football relative to surfing, even at a country level, surfing is still very niche. Surfers, you know, see the surf industry and their, you know, the surf events and the crowded surf breaks they go to, but take that activity away from the coastline or away from the popular spots, and relative to within the UK, cricket, rugby, football, tennis, motorsports, it's extremely small. So what people don't see is the demands to monetize the skills. And I think it's fair and healthy for experts to aspire to, you know, to live professionally off their skills, because we celebrate that in athletics. We celebrate it in all performative activities through music, through dance. And I think that there's not a massive amount of economic opportunities for emerging professional surfers, but it would be nice to create a more robust, supportive system, a better network. And there are kind of two different approaches. One is that I do think we can learn a lot more from the music industry, in the way that you know, surfing and surfers can be empowered at a grassroots level in the way a band may be playing gigs at the local pub and be monetizing, you know, their opportunities. Maybe one day they want to get a record label signing and be playing at Glastonbury. That may never happen, but it may well be a really nice balance with a lot of their, you know, like lower level kind of paychecks to perform. And you can get that in all kind of performance arts. I think surfing could learn a little bit from that at the grassroots level. And then at the more elite level of people going for world titles, I think that we have to continue to learn from the really robust, successful global sports like football in how they support the grassroots and where and when the grassroots turns into sustainable funding opportunities that nurture talent for the long term, but also allow that talent to be learning other skills so that if an injury or a shorter career span happens, they're well placed to then feed back into the next generation coming up or the wider kind of community. And I think it's really important to, you know, really continue within the surfing to discuss elements of sustainability, the role of the brands, the relationships that the sport has to what we call non-endemic brands that maybe will be interested in surfing for certain periods, but may well not make products that surfers buy. But it doesn't mean to say that we're not all interconnected, because we all live on the planet, we all eat food, we need clean water, we need clean energy. And, you know, these things are all linked. So there's opportunities for, you know, the national governing bodies and the global governance to really kind of, you know, discuss and debate these and form really robust networks so that we can nurture our surf communities and the ones that go into the performative side of competitions or content creation at the highest level that excites the community, but also the managers and the organizers and the officials and the judges and the trainers. All of those elements are really key, and the brands themselves need to continue to make sure that they're making products that are ethical and green and sustainable, and that, you know, we're kind of recognizing that our playground is the blue planet and we need to sustain that through our blue economy so that we are making things that will continue to be available for the next generations.
But they have a Premier League for surfing in the UK. Is that like a Premier League almost?
So the aspiration for competitive surfing is to move through to the World Surf League Elite Tour for longboarding or shortboarding. And there's also annual events through the ISA. And now that surfing is in the Olympics, there's that four-year opportunity to win a gold medal through surfing. And that's there for female and male shortboarders. It's not there for longboarding or parasurfing yet. But within the UK, there is a really good range of competitions. And, you know, the fact that surfing is now in the Olympics for all the governing bodies around the world for their sport, they've got you know, federation, kind of government sport money that they can invest into anything that's in the Olympics. And that cycle is really important to create more of a kind of a robust competition network so that, you know, what you learn in the UK can then be taken to like the wider kind of playing field globally.
Sam Bleakley, ladies and gentlemen, Sam, really appreciated this. And thank you for enlightening me about surfing and everything that comes with it. It's more than just a sport, clearly, and I hope the audience realize that as well. What are you currently working on?
Just finished off our annual print longboarder magazine that we do once a year. I'm in a cycle of commentary for World Surf League longboard events. I'm hosting I'm a panel host for a summit on sustainability in surfing, which is an online event with the International Surfing Association. And I'm looking to make a film soon about the surfing exhibition we made for the National Maritime Museum, Falmouth, that celebrates the history of surfing in Cornwall. That's part of my Brilliant Corners series that you can watch online at the World Surf League website. If you go into the website and go to the watch link and find Brilliant Corners, you can see episodes on Madagascar, Zanzibar, Algeria, India, Senegal, and you can watch other episodes, Papua New Guinea, on Netflix in the UK and Europe, from older shows in Ghana, Oman, Sierra Leone, Haiti, Liberia, China, Barbados. And, you know, that the film work is something I've juggled alongside commentary work, book work, magazine work, and having done a lot of curation for this surf exhibition, I think the next phase of work would be potentially more film-based. We've shot a nice film about women surfing in Sao Tome, which is an island off the coast of Gabon that I want to finish the edit of as well, so that I could launch that alongside making a new film about the history of surfing in Cornwall. And that's a really nice way of storytelling and sharing narrative, and also empowering the voices of surf communities as ambassadors for their coastlines, learning from the locals. Not reinforcing stereotypes, but going to places that may well normally be in the media for negatives, and finding the celebrations, the links from the coastline to the art, the food, the music, the performance, and realizing that the local surfers have a big voice in their local communities.
Sounds very, very cool and very exciting. And where can people go if they want to find the work that's already out?
I think the nicest place to go for the Brilliant Corners films is onto the worldsurfleague.com website, and dropping down the links for watch and finding the Brilliant Corners series to look at there. And if you want to do some reading, looking for the Mindfulness and Surfing book, Reflections for Saltwater Souls, I think that's a really nice celebration of lots of the topics we've been talking about.
Perfect. I'll leave the links for those in the description below. Thank you so much for your time, and enjoy the rest of your day surfing with the kids.
Thanks so much, Jacob. Thanks for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure, and great topics to discuss.
If you want to start your own podcast but have no idea where to start, and you want to generate viral social media clips and get your dream guests onto your show, even from just using your laptop in your bedroom like I did, then my Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is exactly for you. It is a private paid course and community that has every single step and process I've used and continue to use to grow this show. And I include every single secret, every single tactic I do and still use that will get you results super fast. And also, if you want to access me personally every single week, then as part of this course, you'll also be able to join live weekly calls where I go through your podcast and answer your questions to get you results much, much faster. So if you want to actually start a podcast and stop dreaming and get millions of social media views and book your dream guests in half the amount of time it took me, then click the first link in the description.